morning, everybody. Hi, how are you going? It's 10 past, so I think we better get going. I know there's quite a number of people still missing. They'll make their way here, I hope. Hopefully the groups that are talking today are here, that's represented, and you've got enough of a number. But anyway, that's it for me. I'm handing over to David. Bye. Hello. Look who I found at the bus stop. So thanks very much. And David's going to hand over, but I'll be around and Glenn's here the rest of the course. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Izu. So, hello, everybody. I'm going to start off from the very beginning. So, between now and noon, what I'd like to cover, I'm going to actually talk about why I'm here and some of my history so you understand the situation. Then I'm going to do the lecture part. We go over the basics because my experience is that people are not always at the same level. And then I'll go over what it is that we're going to be doing for the next couple of days in the intensive session. So a lot of it may be repeat. It's actually all written, but sometimes it's not clear. So I met all of you briefly in System Thinking 1 class. I'm David Ng, and I have this very strange history. I've been coming to Finland since about 2003, and when I came with my friend David Hawk, and I was just visiting, and at that point they had the executive PhD program over in Tuzla. And I was helping David teach his class, and then they asked, well, would you like to teach in the eczema program? And I said, okay, that'd be fun. And then David said, well, while you're here, you might as well finish your PhD, because I started my PhD between 82 and 84, and then I dropped out and joined IBM. And so within a couple of years, the eczema program shut down. And so I became this very strange PhD student in Finland. I live in Canada. My experience, and what you'll find is I don't necessarily have the same standards as other people who teach the classes. My career is 28 years at IBM. I retired in 2012. 12 years of that were in management consulting. I still keep in touch with people at IBM Research. And so when I come to a university, what I look for is what I would normally expect people would be doing if you were working at an IBM level, which is actually pretty high. So for me to be doing things remotely and doing things online and being instant messaging and email sort of stuff is a matter of course. But that's the way I work. So the history of me and the Creative Sustainability Program was that the Creative Sustainability Program was started in 2010. And in 2009, I met one of the people in engineering who had been teaching systems thinking. And actually, we were both visiting in the UK. And he contacted me and said, well, they have this new program, two courses in systems thinking. And he was teaching it, but he said he was doing it in Finnish. And for him to convert over to English would be too much work. And so they decided to ask me to actually write the courses. So I wrote the courses and delivered the courses in 2010 and 2011, which is why they have content. And that content was based off a 2008 meeting at the International Federation of Systems Research Conference. That's a biannual meeting where system thinkers around the world get together, and I was with a group, and we had tried to figure out what are the most basic system concepts that people need to know. And systems is a very large domain. So for those of you who, I know that many of you looked at the reading list and went, oh, this reading list, no one could possibly read that amount of content. That's actually what happens in systems. And the way that systems work is that different people have different perspectives. We get together, we discuss how they're different, how they're the same, some of the commonalities. And so no one knows all of systems. And there are no right answers. So for those of you who are expecting a right answer, that all of a sudden you're going to wake up and you're going to understand it, it doesn't work that way. There are, however, a lot of wrong answers. and people have worked that out and figured out. And so that's what we try to do when we're in the systems community, sharing, as we try to have these discussions about different perspectives and how one applies, one doesn't apply. And that really frames the way that we look at the course. I will talk a little bit about why I'm here now. So when I was here in October, Katri asked if I would teach this class for her because she needed time to finish her PhD. And so she's been diligent about that. And so I said yes, I would do it as long as I didn't lose money, which is a really interesting proposition. And so it turns out that I'll be right up front with you. I think that for coming to this class, I make 17 euros a day. So I'm not doing this for the money. I'm doing it because of favor to the program, and because one of the interesting wrinkles about coming here as a PhD student is, as a PhD student, my education is free. As a Canadian living in Toronto, when I come to Aalto University, my education has been free, and it's been free since 2003. So this is part of the exchange that goes on. There's this other system that works within education exchange. So I've done this sort of program before. The structure of the way that we're going to be running this class is, you might be getting some insight into it. Different people have been studying different bodies, different topics, different clusters within the system thinking. And what you'll find out is that, oh, that's why the class is this way. Because the class is designed specifically as a systems thing. So one of the first, who's the first group? Who's group one? Group one. So you're going to be asked to blog, everyone in this class, by the next class, is going to be asked to blog in an appreciation, as an appreciative system. And the first group is going to tell you what an appreciative system is. So if they're not clear, you need to grill them, right? Who is doing the one on acquiring systems? Someone did some work on acquiring systems?
Yep.
Yeah? Okay, the way that the whole structure of the debate, of the having the taking a position and then having a challenge is part of the acquiring system. So you will learn about systems by operating in a systems way. Now, part of being in the systems community, and we've been in the Creative Sustainability Program, we've been quite successful at this. My personal standard is that if I took you students, after having taken this class, to a systems conference, would you feel uncomfortable? Would you not know the language? And after working with students, I found that there's no problem. By the time you are finished this course, you will go to any systems conference, you go, oh yeah, I've heard about this before. Oh yeah, the name's familiar, I've heard of this before. Now, this is a course that is compulsory here, and no one ever majors in systems thinking. It is a secondary thing. It's like no one majors in critical thinking. People could say that they major in design thinking these days, but they're not really designers sometimes. So it's a way of thinking, and the idea is to get you into the basic concepts and the language associated with it. And you'll find after a while that it becomes natural that when you talk about things, systems is something that is fairly natural to a lot of people, but you tend to not have the vocabulary for it. So the purpose in the lecture, the first lecture I'll just start now, is to get you a little bit immersed into the very basics of the language. So let me jump into that. So some of you may wonder why it is that I actually did the content this way, in pure HTML. Can anyone think about why I would do the content this way? A systems approach. You have to also bear in mind that I was a management consultant at IBM. I can do PowerPoint, I can do multimedia, I can do blogging, I can do all sorts of stuff. Why did I do all this content in HTML?
Isn't it to see like what's behind the sign, like the system behind the websites?
No, not exactly. Why?
You can evolve it. It's not ready.
That's part of it. The main reason that this content is on this website and in HTML is when you're in China, can you access this website? And the answer is yes. If you looked when you came into the coalvolving.com Alto, the content from 2010 was there. You can compare this course to the course in 2010. It's always been there, it always will be there. So when we think about the world, and we think about the system, how big is your system? What does it include? Does it include that people in China can actually access your content? So this is one of the things that came to me working in IBM. IBM was designed as a multinational company, and my expectation was that I would always have access to everything I'd worked on, and it would be in the public, and you know, I could communicate with people. And it takes a little bit of work to do that outside. So I had asked, and I will reiterate for you, that I would like your content to be in the public. The worst thing to me in schoolwork is if you hand in your schoolwork on a university website, the only people that really read it are you and me, and I grade it. When I ran this course in 2010, we actually ran it on a different website, and we actually had people from Argentina commenting on it. And when you're in the systems community, how big is your system? Who can you communicate with? How do they interact with you? So we want this communication, we want this interaction to happen as frequently as possible. So when I wrote the course in 2010, I had to redo all these slides. So when you started in January, and I wasn't quite done, it was because I was finishing these slides, because since then, since 2010, the web standards have evolved. So this is scalable vector graphics, which means I can draw things, vector graphics, on the web. And I couldn't do that back in 2010. So it made the text unreadable. So anyway, let's start off with the systems basics. I had you look at the Rethinking Systems Thinking article, which is a long article. And that is the maybe the definitive work that comes as my role as president of the International Society for System Sciences. My concern about systems thinking is that I claim that system thinking died in about in the mid-90s. And when you go and take a course in systems thinking, quite often what happens is that they teach old people like Russ Acuff. So Acuff, 1999, he died in 2003, was it? And people think, oh, then system thinking is not active anymore. But system thinking is actually alive and well. There are a lot of people who are still alive, still doing research, and pushing the ideas forward. And so the focus of the Rethinking Systems Thinking talk was, don't stop in the 1990s. And there are a lot of people who are systems thinkers and are recognized system community that people don't think about. So how many of you have you heard of Jane Jacobs as an example? So Jane Jacobs, urbanist, right? So her major claim to fame was she had written a book called The Life and Death of Great American Cities, right? And then she actually moved to Toronto. She was living in Toronto when we had the ISSS meeting in 2000. She came and spoke, not as part of the conference, but she lived in Toronto. She came to give a talk. But if you ever have issues with trying to understand why Jane Jacobs writes the way she does and understands the world the way she does, it's because she's a systems thinker. People who don't understand her think that she's a leftist, that she always thinks that communities are the way to design cities, neighborhoods are important, these sorts of things. And then they think, oh, she's just off the left, she's one of these, you know, socialist types. But then she says something that's actually counter, and they say, wow, that's not on the left at all, that's on the right. And it's because systems thinking doesn't necessarily peg you towards the left or the right. It's about thinking about the system as a whole. So, the David Ing definition, the only one you get from me and the one that I do very, very frequently. System thinking is a perspective on parts, wholes, and their relations. That's the simplest one. That's all it is, systems. Now, that gets really complicated because we have the idea of perspectives, and in mindset, you cover the idea of perspectives. So different people will see different things as systems. Parts, wholes, and their relations. So we get into the various combinations of parts, wholes, and their relations. The basic ideas in systems, we have function, structure, and process. So what is function? Function is contribution of the part to the whole. So there's a relation, right? Parts and wholes. If you talk to someone about systems, just ask them, well, what's the part, what's the whole? Are you talking about the part, are you talking about the whole? So what is the function of the heart in your body? Function of your heart is to pump blood around, circulate. What is the function of an engine in a car? It's to drive it, right? So function is one of the most basic ideas. And it's pretty common in all cultures. So I've actually done work in China, and if we go to China and we start talking about function, structure, or process, they understand it just fine. The same concepts are available in China because it's so old. We're talking going back to the ancient Greeks. Structure is arrangement in space, and it is part-part interactions. Okay. So what is the interaction, say, between a bus and a tram? Okay, they meet at a terminal, they're two parts of a transit system. Okay, now we're talking about the whole, which is a transit system. We talk about the parts, which are tram, bus. The third one, process is arrangement in time. So you have a part, and you have a part changing over time. Skill testing question, which comes first, process or structure?
Process.
Process, why?
Because it can self rearrange at the time and find a system that fits for the structure could reshape my life.
Okay, close. Anyone else want to try? Anyone believe that structure comes first? Okay, how many people think that process comes before structure? How many people think that structure becomes process? How many have no idea? Okay, so here's a clue about how long it takes. I was 8 years in the systems community before I got an answer to this. And I was just walking across the parking lot and I asked one of the ex-presidents, which comes first, structure or process? And he says, oh, that's simple. Process always comes first. I said, why? And he said, because structure is the slowest changing process ever. So you see a mountain, and people think that a mountain is part of the structure. It's part of the landscape. But mountains also change. So there's illusion going on about structure. When you think about structure, you're now tied in perspective. Because when you look at the mountain, if your lifetime was millennia, as opposed to being, you know, 80 to 100 years, your perspective would be different on the way you look at the mountain. Okay, so parts, wholes, and their relations. Now this gets more complicated because I've been talking about part, but there's also whole relations. Can we think of a whole-whole relation? Does anyone want to give an example of a whole-whole relation? Any whole-whole relation?
Socio-ecological system. Socio-ecological system. There's like the social system and the ecological system, and then they create another whole. So like two subsystems creating a larger system.
Okay, well, maybe not.
Or maybe they're part of the whole. It depends how you see it.
See, now this is when, like, we're just starting off here with systems, right? We're trying to get the basic ideas down. And so, It's hard to tease out these ideas. It's like obvious. It's like, you know, parts, wholes, and relations. And you're like, okay, whole relation. So the reason I'm hesitating on yours is because if you have a social system and an ecological system, they're actually perspectives because you could be looking at the same system. But if you take, so we are actually whole. So I am a whole and you are a whole. We are interacting. And we're wholes, right? You could have a lake and another lake, and they're wholes. You could have one continent, another continent, and there could be wholes because they exist on their own. Yes?
But then could you also see that as part in a larger
system? A larger system, yes. And so this is when you get into the interesting discussion of containing whole. Now, what's it mean to be a containing whole? So, let's talk about a tram, okay? A tram can be contained within a transit system. A tram can also be contained within a financial system. Because when you get on, you pay a fare. In the current way that we've been doing things in the city of Toronto, which is pretty well same here or anywhere, it can be part of a political system. Some people get trams, other people don't get trams. So when you're looking at a system, you end up having to think about what is a containing whole.
Containing whole is a big part of the system.
Yes, and so when you draw a system, now I've used a puzzle piece here, but when you draw a system, people normally draw a circle, right? And they say everything, they have the system and they have the environment outside, but it's actually a dotted line. It's not a solid line between what's inside the system and what's outside the system. But when you talk about containing whole, there are multiple containing wholes. Now, one of the most basic works, which I don't think was on the reading list, Angill, 1941, was on the structure of wholes. And this was an idea that within yourself, you have multiple wholes within yourself.
There are systems with different hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
What I read was that, like, if human is a whole, then organism inside him is also whole, but they have kind of role to the bigger whole, and then it comes smaller and smaller until it comes to like a cell, which is still a system.
Okay, there are, so when you talk about a system, then you end up having to talk about function, structure, and process. So if it has function, structure, and process, you end up not, so when we talk about the cell, there is the cell, but the cell is not by itself. The cell exists in an environment, right?
And because it's an open system.
Yes, open system,
yep.
Correct. Yeah.
So I don't know if it's related to what you want to say.
Well, no, you're on the right track, which is, so you're coming down to saying, well, you can have things at many different levels, many different scales. They're all systems. So then you'd have to ask the question, well, what is not a system? So someone want to try what's not a system then?
When these parts doesn't have then the interrelations, they are not interacting.
Okay.
Then they don't form a system.
Right. So typically a network is not considered to be a system. Yeah, you could make it a system if you configure it and have a purpose when you're defining it. So as an example, we talk about the internet. The internet is not a system unless you define a boundary around parts of the internet. Right? So Aalto University has a network and is defined as part of the big internet. And so we say, okay, that is a system. But to say that the internet is a system, well, then you have to ask, well, what's the purpose? What would be the containing whole for the system? Is a containing whole like the whole world? Is the internet about a communications? Is it about a broadcast network? Is it about an educational network? What is the purpose in the containing whole?
But as soon as you define it, that becomes a system.
Okay, so now you come down to the question about, do systems really exist? Well, it's actually a great philosophical question, because systems don't really exist. Systems are something that human beings use as a representation of the world so we can communicate with each other. And so the first question that usually comes up when we talk about systems, and that's going to be not today, but in the second group is going to handle, is boundary. What is the boundary of what you're talking about? Right? Yes.
I was thinking about the internet example, because
okay.
You said that systems are something that exist on their own,
mm-hmm.
but internet doesn't really exist if we don't make the action of using it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it something that exists on its own? Is it a system in that sense? Like, even if it's, even if you say that it's only the Aalto website or whatnot, it has a boundary, but does it really exist on its own?
A system always has a boundary, and there's an environment outside of that. So if you can define the boundary, then you get down to the question of function, structure, process. So if something has no function, then you start to ask, well, if it has no function, then is it a system? Well, it may be a system, but it's not usually worth discussing because it has no function.
So does a system, can it function on its own?
If it's an open system, then it requires something from the outside of the system.
Okay. So it kind of reacts rather than...
It could react or it could respond.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it's still a subjective definition of...
Yes.
What, so it is a system if I define it to be a system. So it's all subjective.
Yes.
And it's all... No, but it's like, it is a system if you find... If you define... function for it. So, you know, it's very subjective.
Right.
And as you said, if you define it, that you can define everything. You can just define it.
Yeah, this is what happens, is that this is why systems thinking is so slippery. And we end up always back to the basics about which system are you describing? And then you often have a discussion about what is the containing whole for that system. Okay. Let me go down a little bit. Now, you'll find that I actually use Russ Acuff a lot when I talk about systems. And it's not because I necessarily agree with Russ, but Russ is clear. He is the most cited author in systems thinking, and you know where he stands. And so if you disagree, that's okay, we can discuss that, because I may disagree as well. However, he writes very, very clearly. So in 1981, he wrote about our changing concept of the world, And he talked about these differences, where he talks about the machine age and the systems age, and trying to bridge this, 1981. Now, what did he mean by the systems age? He said, the nature of a system, a whole that cannot be divided into independent parts. A whole that cannot be divided into independent parts. So if you define that whole, is that the same whole as everyone else is describing? Because you can't take it apart, right? It will have some unique function that makes it a system. In the machine age was analysis. In the systems age, he described system thinking. And what does system thinking mean? Synthesis precedes analysis. Synthesis is putting things together. Analysis is taking things apart. Now, this is my single test of whether I'm talking to an authentic system thinker or not. Because there are a lot of people that say they're systems thinkers, and we debate them in the forums and online. And what I find is that there are people who are very reductive because they do analysis. And if I look in particular, engineering, I work with the systems engineering community. Systems engineers are really great at being reductive. They are really good at analysis. And I was at the ECOSI meeting. Russ Acuff has a saying, which is, you want to do, there's two ways of approaching a problem. One is to do the right thing wronger, and the other one is do the wrong thing righter. So do you want to do the wrong thing righter, or the wrong, or the right thing wronger? Let's break that down a little bit. Do you want to do the right thing or the wrong thing? Now, if you try to do the right thing and you're an engineer, you have to bound your system, and so you may end up doing the wrong thing. So if you're an engineer, hardcore engineer, hardcore technical engineer, my son's an engineer, so I'm not going to insult it. I'm not an engineer, but my son is. And so we get this comparison. In order for things to get done in a finite period of time, so the one thing that systems engineers are really good at, they're on schedule. They run meetings, they get things done, they realize that things are at version 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, and they're trying to do the right thing. But sometimes they end up doing the wrong thing because they want to make the time shorter. And if you do you start off with the wrong thing, you may never be able to get to the right thing. So I've been at systems engineering meeting, and they say, oh yes, we always do the wrong thing righter. They start off with the wrong thing, they start trying to correct it. Acuff says we should do the right thing wronger, because when you know it's wrong, you can correct it, and you can make it better, and that's what learning is all about, an adaptation of the system. So, synthesis precedes analysis. Analysis, taking things apart, but what you want to do is synthesis first, putting things together. Now, synthesis is fundamentally, people who are trained as designers, this is what you end up doing. Designers are really oriented towards doing synthesis. However, it's really interesting when we see a designer and an engineer working together, and you're wondering what that rub is. And that rub is generally because the designer is trying to do the right thing in their perception, and they perceive that the engineer is trying to do the wrong thing, and it won't lead to the right thing. And so then the question is, can you get the engineer turn around and start doing the right thing wronger? And the way to do that is not by going into the parts, but going into the containing whole. The way that you judge the world, the way you judge whether something is right, is not inside the system, it is outside the system. Anyone want to take an example? Brian, example. This one's tough. Go ahead.
Usually in the projects, if you, like in architecture projects, if you want in your team something, to get a person, like engineer or architect, to join your team and bring the new ideas,
mm-hmm.
you explain the concept of the project, the main idea whole
mm-hmm.
for the project, and you don't describe the kind of systems or your ideas how you could make it work, because then he will not bring his own perspective and vision on how he can improve the system.
Okay. Let me make a suggestion then, which is, for most projects, there's usually a customer. The customer is outside the system, and most of the time the customer is right. Sometimes the customer is wrong, in which case you now have a very interesting discussion with the customer about whether they're right or they're wrong. It could be they need to learn, but you need something outside the system in order to tell you that you're doing the right thing. Say something?
Yeah, it somehow reminds me of the social participants in the project
mm-hmm.
for size. Last semester, we were doing an urban design project. After we submit our proposal, we just submit into the Facebook group for the local residents.
Mm-hmm.
So they somehow collected some comments and suggestions from the local residents,
mm-hmm.
which can affect our final proposal.
Okay. Participation is interesting challenge or problem, because it takes time and resources to do participation. And there's a trade-off, which, who are the people that are doing post-normal science? That's the one you're going to end up discussing. Because you can have people who participate, or you can have experts. And you end up with this trade-off that experts may know better, or they might not know better. The experts may be their own system, or they have access to a different system of knowledge or ideas. So let's table that for now. The idea is right. We'll discuss it when they get to present. OK. Synthesis precedes analysis. What do? Identify, in this order, firstly, identify a containing whole system of the thing to be explained as a part. Okay? So we'll go back to the tram, a single tram. It's part of a larger system. Are you talking about the financial system because of budgeting thing? It could just be a financial system you're talking about, because that's a containing whole. You've already bought all of these trams. They're all operating. And so the problem is the expense running them. That could be the containing whole. Explain the behavior or property of the containing whole. Okay, wait a minute. We're talking about the part. We're talking about the tram. Now we're talking about the financial system. Okay? So what is the behavior in the financial system? Oh, there's not enough money in the budget. Okay, why would there not be enough money in the budget? Well, in case of City of Toronto, there's always taxes that go back and forth between the city and the province. So maybe it's underfunded at that level. So the problem is not in the tram, the problem could be in the containing whole. Thirdly, explain the behavior property of the thing to be explained, which is a part, in terms of the role or function within its containing whole. So how well is the tram doing in that financial system? Well, doing pretty well, given the amount of money it's got. Right? So if you want a better financial system, you give it more money, which means you're working on containing whole level. So now you're going to get my personal opinion on leverage points, and why leverage points are not the way you want to work. So anyone want to think about why leverage points are not necessarily the way you want to work? You did readings on Liebrich points. That's not in this course, right? But yeah, have you done Liebrich points reading before? Okay. And you thought it was good? Yeah. Okay. I come from a different school. Given what I've just told you about systems thinking.
I was just about to say that maybe if I'm managing a company and I want to work with leverage points, but I have to be outside of the system, then I have to be inside the system. I don't feel like I'm able to recognize the, the absolute myself and the mindset of the system. You know, when it's just mindset gets bigger and bigger and the first leverage point. But I'm so inside the system, I'm not able to.
Good. The leverage, the best leverage points are in the containing whole. The best leverage points are not in the system, they are in the containing whole. If you want a better tram system, don't yell at the tram driver. It's not his fault. You go to City Hall, you go to the state, that's where your leverage point is. Any other comments?
Depends where you put your containing hole, though.
Yes, it does depend where you put your containing hole.
There are the different I don't know, vertical levels and horizontal levels, and there are the leverage point.
Yes.
And then the containing hole is like a sphere.
Uh huh.
Then depends which leverage point between the sphere.
Yes, and there are multiple containing holes that conflict with each other. Yes. So this is why system thinkers are a little strange, because they never go where you expect them to go. They're trying to work in the containing hole. Let me give you an example that happened fairly recently. So I don't know, on LinkedIn, have people seen System Thinking World? System Thinking World is a LinkedIn group with 20,000 people in it. October 31st, Gene Bellinger, the guy that runs that group, posted that I'm going to delete this group. 20,000 people without a group. And so he went through a little machination and stuff like that. And so finally, he handed off to someone who kind of dropped it and then got picked up and got restarted. So back again. But we're also on Facebook. And so the solution that they came up with was, okay, we won't have one administrator or multiple administrators. Okay, that's a fix, but that's not a real long-term solution. The problem with LinkedIn as a discussion group is that it's a commercial enterprise. And so if they decide they don't want your content anymore, it's like, it's gone. If Facebook decides they don't want your content anymore, it's gone. So if you want to actually have an online community and you want to dissolve the problem, you need to go to the containing hole. Do you want to deal with LinkedIn? Do you want to deal with Facebook? Do you want to deal with these organizations? So I'm working now on a new online platform with the IFSR, because we're trying to get over those boundaries. Russ Acuff has a definition of differentiation between solving the problem and dissolving the problem. When you solve a problem, you fix that initial problem. Dissolving the problem makes it go away. The simplest example of this, any mother here with more than one child? You have two kids fighting over a toy. What do? If you have two kids fighting over a toy?
You
split the toy. That would solve the problem. Split the toy in half. Dissolving the problem is taking the toy away, so neither one of them has it. That's dissolving the problem. It's not solving the problem. Splitting it in half would definitely solve the problem, but no one's very happy with that. Okay. So we have this idea of nature of system. Now, associated with this, there's also some other stuff going on. One is determinism versus expansionism. determinism says that the world, the future is preordained. And in the machine idea of the world, when we get to physics, when you roll a ball, it always goes at the same speed, you can repeat it, and it always does the same thing, because you have this determinism. But what happens with systems thinking is you have this idea of expansionism. We've been talking about containing holes, so now you realize, oh my God, there's not only one containing hole, there's multiple containing holes, and you start having this discussion about which of the containing holes make sense and where can you have impact, where can you have influence. Reductionism, that's doing analysis before synthesis. Mechanism is machine oriented. So people tend to, when we talk about examples, we often make it easy to talk about machines. But you think about the, using the word mechanism, because we use the word mechanism quite often in our vocabulary. Oh, what is the selection mechanism for that? You ever thought of using the word organism? Let's suppose selection mechanism, what would a selection organism be? Because it's different when you think about it. In systems idea, we have producer product. Okay, this is a very old philosophical argument. Okay, I want to grow an oak tree. What's it take to grow an oak tree?
Another oak tree.
Okay, but what do you need for that? We're going to start one from scratch. What do you need for an oak tree?
A seed.
Okay, so we need an acorn. So, okay, I have an acorn. Is that sufficient? Okay, so what else do we need?
Earth.
Yes, what else do we need?
Water, sun.
Water, okay. We can keep going like this, right? Okay, so if I give you the acorn, I give you water, I give you earth, will you guarantee me an oak tree? No. Okay, so now we'll go down the list, you know, start creating 100 things. Will you guarantee me an oak tree? And the answer is no, only God creates oak trees. There's this idea, and I'm not a religious person. For me to give a story, I use the word God. It's interesting. Producer product has this idea that you could have all the parts and still not have a whole. Now, you know for sure if you're missing some of the parts, you won't have a whole. But even if you have all the parts, it may not guarantee the whole. But thinking about the leverage points, when you're trying to move something, you could have all the leverage points you want, and you still may not get there. And that's something that you have to accept when it's a system. The last idea is teleology. Anyone hear philosophy? Can give me a definition of teleology? No philosophers. Have to rob the course. Teleology is a study of ends, goals, objectives. Machines don't have goals or objectives or purposes on their own. What do you need to have a purpose? A function? A purpose is a special kind of function. It is the ultimate function. The purpose is the ultimate function. But what do you need to have a function? To have a function, you need the containing whole. Now, here's where Russ is really clear, and people are welcome to disagree. And it gets philosophical. Do you need a goal? Do you need an end? What's the purpose in your life? Most of you just are going to get through this lecture at the end of the lunch, right? But what's the purpose in your life? Do you need a purpose in your life?
Well, it depends how big you are. Imagine your containing hole now.
Very good. Yes, depends which containing hole and how long, how big it is. But some people could just live, right? You don't need to have purpose. Just live day to day. However, we talk about mechanisms, machines. A machine only has a purpose when a human being is associated with it, generally. So we're talking about doing the right thing and the wrong thing. The person could be part of the containing hole. I'll get into that a little bit more as we go down. So I'd already talked about structure, function, and process. This is actually the text from Jamshi Gaharagadagi, who was working with Rasekhov. But they wrote this interesting article, Reflections on Systems and Their Models. And he categorized four types of systems. There is a deterministic system where the part doesn't have purpose or choice, and the whole doesn't have purpose or choice. So an engine doesn't choose to be an engine, and a car doesn't choose to be a car. It's a machine. We have animated systems. Animated systems are not purposeful in the parts, but they're purposeful in the whole. So, my heart doesn't choose to be a heart, but I as an individual have human will. Now there's an interesting question here, and the reason why it's called animated and not organism is, now we get the question, do trees have purposes?
Yes.
Why do you think a tree has a purpose?
They are the lungs of the world. That's their purpose. But they do serve a purpose for the, like, for the, you know, like, natural nature.
Okay.
For function.
Does anyone disagree with that? Yes?
Well, it depends on whether we want all the other things to exist.
Yeah. but if there's you, there are no humans, they still have their, like, they, everything in the nature is found for a reason.
But for what reason? Like,
to
we're in a huge universe. It doesn't really make any difference if we don't exist.
Well, if there are no humans, it's still like, you don't need humans to have the Earth. No?
Yeah, I know, but trees are there for other than humans as well.
I would say it's part of a larger system. It has a function. So, as before mentioned, maybe it doesn't need a purpose because the hole is bigger than its system. It's too big, so maybe it doesn't need actually a purpose in a way.
Mm.
It has a function, it has a purpose. Anyway.
Yes?
They have a purpose, like when I have a flower, a purpose is to try to alive. When I put a flower, they only go toward the sun, so they wish for something to be alive.
Okay, I'm going to give you Russ Acoff's definition, and you can agree or disagree. Remember, I told you he's clear, but you have to agree or disagree. In Russ Acoff's definition, an animated system can move. When it moves, it demonstrates choice. The choice reflects purpose or goals. For him, a tree does not have purpose because a tree doesn't choose to move. A tree grows up and it grows out and it gets blown in the wind, but it doesn't have choice. So the word animated was very, very specific. If you disagree, you have your own system philosophy. It's okay. Russ Acoff's, this is his categorization and this is how he does it. Yes?
Then it would be the same for humans, right? Like, I never chose to be human. I can end my life, but then I would still be human.
But you can choose now. You raise your hand. You chose to raise your hand.
But you said, like, choose to be human. The tree doesn't choose to be a tree.
But
I also don't choose to be a...
It doesn't have a goal. It doesn't move. The tree doesn't move.
But that's so disconnected from the, basically from everything, like reality. It's only like, it doesn't matter. Nature works how it works.
And yes.
it's insignificant to its operations, whether the guy has a definition for it.
Yes.
So in that sense, that's very disconnected from everything.
Okay.
What did you say? Because a tree does have, like, everything in nature has, if you look at all the, like, everything living is, like, if you look at the human body,
uh-huh.
all the parts have some kind of a meaning. Like, what does the heart do? Why is it so, blah, 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 this kind of thing. So it's very disconnected if you say that a tree doesn't have a purpose because of a set of, according to one school of thought.
Yes, it is a school of thought.
Yeah.
Right.
So
yes.
Why, this is like not related to this probably, but why systems thinking out of all the schools of thought?
No, this is just one person within all of systems thinking. So one of the things about this course, and it's built into the structure, is you will all individually have a different view of systems thinking. And I'm okay with that. So if you disagree with Russ Aycock, I disagree with Russ Aycock too. Not necessarily on this point, because I've done a little more reading and the work I find useful. But you know. But there are a lot of people that don't like Russ Aycock's purposeful systems. One of the people, did someone read Stafford Beer's work? Okay, so within the viable systems model, viable system model was originally done by Stafford Beer, and he and Russ Aycock were really good friends, and so they had he wrote this article for a festschrift, it was in celebration of Russ Aycock, and he says this alien comes down from another planet, observes this really large land with lawn. And he sees rabbits on it. And there's a hunter, and the hunter has a gun. And what he notices is that when the rabbit jumps, he jumps right in front of the bullet. So every time, he's saying, why on earth do they have suicidal rabbits?
It's just
an image. It has to do with the perspective on it, right? So his perception is that the purpose of the rabbit is to jump in front of bullets. That's the way that Stafford Beer made fun of Russ Aycock. But if you look at businesses, which are purposeful systems, you end up with a lot of people thinking and discussing these sorts of questions. What is the purpose? What's our goal? What is to do this year? What do we have to do to get our bonus, do whatever? People are very goal-oriented. Some are goal-oriented. Can you understand what their goals are? So, third category. Social systems. Purposeful in the parts, purposeful in the whole. So, each of us individually, as part of a social system, has choice. And as a group, we also have choice. Now, this is a really interesting diversion because when you go into Russ Aycock, he starts getting into ideals. Russ Aycock, when he wrote On Purposeful Systems in 1972, which was a refinement of his dissertation work, he wrote with Fred Emery. Aycock believed that groups can share ideals. Fred Emery did not believe that groups can share ideals. There's this definition of goals, objectives, and ideals. A goal is something that can be achieved within a period plan. So typically we have like 1 year plans. You have objectives, which can be achieved not within the period plan, but are worth pursuing. So you say, well, can't get done in a year, but it's going to be worth it to invest in this project. We'll do something and get done in 5 years. That'll be great. And then there are ideals, which are worth striving for, but are not attainable. So this is like ultimate beauty, ultimate justice, morality, these sorts of things. And you end up with these questions about whether people can or cannot share ideals. We're definitely into the philosophical here. This is teleology. The last category, ecological, purposeful in the parts, but not purposeful in the whole. So we can have influence over our local country, our local town, but can we change the whole world? Now, the world tends to be an ecology. Another one could be like a stock market. You may be able to manipulate one stock. Manipulating the whole stock market is pretty tough. Okay. Yes.
What comes to my mind is, I don't know, couldn't he just use functional instead of purposeful in some of these? Because
yes.
Like in animated or in ecological, it would be more meaningful, I guess.
Okay, so Russ is clear, and so what he describes is that there are functions and there are essential functions. And the example he already talks about is a cigarette lighter in a car has a function, but it's not an essential function. So if you're, usually you can drive a car without having a cigarette lighter in it. Purpose is essential. So it's a special type of function. So yes, purposes are functions.
But we're discussing about tree and animated nature,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking maybe purpose is just for tinkers, for human. I
yes,
mean.
Yes.
But even for like for a cat, for a rabbit, what could we say? Is it a purpose or is the function?
Okay, I'm going to leave that now. We can debate that with her later. But this is exactly what we get into, is even among systems thinkers, there's all these little fine points about, okay, well, what is it? But we end up in philosophy pretty quickly and having these sorts of discussions. Okay. Did anyone actually get a chance to watch the How Buildings Learn videos? Was it cool? Not cool?
Well, I like that compared to modern documentaries.
Okay.
It actually had some content. Or, I mean, like nowadays, a lot of the documentaries are like very fast and try to, I don't know.
Okay.
They just don't get anything set, I feel. But this was, it was a bit, it felt a bit old, but at the same time, it was quite nice in the sense that there was some hope.
Okay, let me give you the context for the How Buildings Learn project. So Stuart Brand, he's one of the original thinkers, created the Whole Earth Catalog back in the 1970s. And what the question was actually about was about organizational learning. He wanted to research organizational learning. But you can't study organizational learning because there's actually no history on it. So what he did instead was said, okay, let's study something that's been around a little bit longer, and let's study buildings. The way that most people, now, Stuart Brand is a system thinker extraordinaire. The way that most people think about buildings is that you have the building as a system, and you have the people inside of it. You have the people as the containing whole, right? What if you flip it the other way around, and you have people as the system, and the building as the containing whole? So a building can be a system that learns. And when you use the word learns, that means it evolves over time and adapts to the environment. So it takes an idea about systems that flips it inside out, because the first question is, which system are you talking about? Are you talking about a building with the occupants in it, or are you talking the other way around? So he's saying, buildings learn because the people that live in them change the building. Now, he's created this idea of what he originally had called shearing layers, and the book is called Shearing Layers, but subsequently called pacing layers. Start off with sight. The it's a geographic setting, site's internal, and so this is the slowest changing layer. You take the site, you add on the structure, which are the load-bearing walls. You put the skin on the outside, protect it from the weather. Inside the load-bearing walls, you have the services. You have communications, wiring, electrical wiring, plumbing, all the HVAC stuff. Inside the space plan, inside the services, you have the space plan. You have non-load-bearing walls. And inside the space plan, you have stuff, which is all the furniture, the chairs, all the stuff. Yes?
Do you have to divide the people into one system and the building into one system, or can't they together be they containing all of the systems?
Now, in this case, we're just looking for how the building changes. So we're not including the people. The people are So we look at it two ways. So one would be that the people adapt to the building. But what he's saying is, look at it the other way around. Look at how the building adapts to the people. Okay. Now, the way that you look at this is that you now have constraints. Because if you want to do a change in the building, you end up having constraints around it. So the interesting comparison, what's the difference between an armoire and a closet? Armoire, a piece of furniture where you hang, you put your clothes and stuff like that, versus a closet. They both actually have the same function. They both store clothes. But an armoire is part of the furniture. It's part of the stuff. A closet is part of the space plan. If you move, you leave the house, you can take the armoire with you. If you move and you have a closet, you cannot take the closet with you. So when you are designing, do you design the habitat with the closet or with the armoire? Well, it depends how long you're going to live there. If you look at this as a systems idea, one of the parts that people don't get quite right is when you think about, and we kind of hit on this with structure and process. Systems also have changes over time, so we have time relationships, and they have constraints. So, say we're going to take out that wall there. Is that wall load-bearing? I don't know. It doesn't look load-bearing to me. I think this one's probably load-bearing.
No. That is, that's not.
That's not, right. Yeah. Okay, so that's not load-bearing. So we can take out that wall without destroying the whole place. This one's going to be a problem, right? So there are constraints around this. So when you're thinking about changing a system, you have these constraints that rub against each other. When you're looking for leverage points, you may not be able to actually have a leverage because of the constraints around it. For those of you who are doing resilience and panarchy, this is really about constraints. It's the same sort of thing that happens in the resilience and panarchy literature. Different way of expressing it. So, I like the video, because when you now get the context about how buildings learn is about change, and how that change happens, it's a systems constraint issue. Okay. I think I've spoken enough about systems in the introduction. And there's puzzled faces on everyone. Let me flip over back to the outline, and let's go to the very top and talk about what this course is about. Okay. So, The way that we designed this course, now this was not actually my design, this was Kathy's design. Group discussion, 60%, individual, 15%, and the individual, 25%. Now the idea behind the group collaboration, you'll get into, was on the inquiring system. What we're going to do is have you come up and present a position, and the inquiring system people will explain why later. But what we're looking for you to cover, and hoping it'll come up in the conversation, I hope you've been structuring stuff this way, is thinking about the ideas in the what and how, the who and why, and the when and where, range of context. And why are we doing it that way? We're talking about systems, and we're talking about the containing whole. Each one of the system's ideas is within a containing whole. So the idea of boundary is related to other things within system thinking, but you have to try to balance all the things together. So there's a containing whole that all these things go in. There's a range of contexts where things make sense, and the things where they don't, range where they don't make sense. We've been talking about the tree. Okay, there's an example of where the idea of purpose may make sense or might not make sense. And it's up for you to try to make sense of that. You've been preparing presentations, and so this afternoon we'll have the first presentation. On the way that we'll run these sessions, we'd like people to sit in groups because there is the presentation group, and there are the challenge groups. Now, the intent was that the presentation group actually manages the whole 1 hour and 45 minutes that comes with it. So I'll be sitting in the back. I may have comments, but I'm actually looking forward to you having your own discussion. So part of the group responsibility, people leading the discussion, is that you lead the discussion. You have an hour to do the presentation, 45 minutes for the discussion. Everyone in the group gets the same grade. So Glenn and I are meeting afterwards, and we'll be reading how your performance is. I wouldn't worry about it too much. It's not a big deal. But individual appreciation. This is the blog, and it's a very short horizon I want you to do these in. I want you to do these blogs by noon before the next class. So it means we're having a class on Friday, so by noon on Thursday, I'd like you to blog about what you learned during the whole day. And if you need some guidance on that, the appreciative system approach will be good. So there's a reality judgment. What's real for you about what you heard today? Could end up writing about trees. It's fine. Are these system ideas connecting, or are they fragmented? Because a lot of things don't hang together when you look at them in a single model. When you look across a lot of systems ideas, and they tend to work together better. Which systems ideas are resonating for each of you, and which ones remain a mystery? So it's okay to know what you don't know. Knowing what you don't know is actually a good point, because then you can do research and do learning out. And the last part, where and when might the system's ideas be useful in my research, my career, and or my life? And this is where we really get the departure, because each one of you come to this class with a different background. And systems resonate with different people in different ways. I took my sons to systems conferences, and they've been to a couple. I have four sons, so various age when they come. But it turns out that systems didn't resonate for them until they went to Thomas Wong's presentation, which was about Eastern approaches, Chinese approaches to looking at systems. So again, the yin and yang and all sorts of stuff. And they go, oh, now I understand systems. I go, well, that's great. That's not the way I teach it, but if that's the way you understand systems, that's good for you. So what I'm looking for is on these blog posts is for you to try to create your own sense about what it is that you've learned. Is it resonating for you? And the idea is not that you have to cover everything. It's just what strikes you, what you get out of it, what you don't understand is also fine, or things that are inconsistent. And I would prefer it was blogging in public. Because if we put it behind the website, I will accept if people want to put their blog on inside Aalto. That's okay. I prefer it on the outside. But there's two steps to it. Firstly, you guys have to get your own blog. And then you need to notify. I prefer that on Google Plus. And we can go over that again at the end. I'll make sure that everyone gets up to date on that. But the idea is not to create a large piece of work. The idea is to get you primed towards thinking about a few things, a couple of paragraphs before the next class, and you need to use academic citation styles. So you can't just say, I thought about this. You could say, well, you know, I thought about this, but I've read this other author, and he says this, and this is different. It means something to me different. And we'll cover this again at the end. We'll have the individual appreciation. And that's pretty well all the content. Okay. Do people know what we're going to do today? So, group one. Where's group one? Okay. You okay? You know what we're going to do today?
Mm-hmm.
You got it all planned out? Okay. And we have groups four. Group four is where? Okay. If you could sit together when we come back. And group seven? Okay. Sit together. So group four and seven, it's your responsibility to keep group one sharp. Because you have a different, you studied something different. And what we're going to do is synthesis. This is the interesting part about running this class in synthesis. What's important is that we put the ideas together, not that we take them apart. Okay?
Why are they the only ones taking part in the discussion?
Because we're not restricting it to them, but because of dialectic, which we'll do in the inquiring systems one, we actually need another side. So if I didn't assign an opponent, then I couldn't be sure that we'd actually have a discussion. So it's a responsibility thing. So design and acquiring systems. So ask the question again when we do design and acquiring systems, because we should have a security acquiring system when we do it. If not, then we're not moving forward. Okay. Anything else? We're break for lunch. We meet at 1 o'clock.
All good.
All good?
Good.
Thanks.
Thank you.